Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. And as you may know, the network is run by volunteers. There are about 100 of us, but we do have expenses. So we'd like to ask you to contribute a little something if you can. If you enjoy the programming we produce, then we hope that you will take a moment to go to any New Books Network page and hit the button that says Donate to NBN. And whether you contribute or not, we'd like to thank you for listening to the network. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network and also the host of New Books in History. Today, I am happy to say we have Timothy Schenck on the show, but I'll be calling him Tim, as he requested. And he's written a wonderful book about somebody that I read when I was an undergraduate, Maurice Dobb. And the name of the book is Maurice Dobb, Political Economist. As I say, a long time ago when there were Marxists, there may still be Marxists, I think. But there were a lot of them back in the 80s when I first started to read this stuff. Dobb was essential reading. For me, it was a great treat to kind of bring the brilliance, which is Maurice Dobb, back to my mind and also remember an age in which we thought of things in a little broader way than we do today. I guess I would put it that way. So, Tim, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Marshall. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Could you kick things off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm a graduate student in history at Columbia right now. I'm working on a dissertation focusing on U.S. political economy in the 20th century, but I've had this Dobb project sort of going as like a side endeavor for a few years now. Started working on it in September 2008, about. So it's great to see it finally out and like letting other people in the world be able to see what I've been working on furtively for so many years.
Yeah. I was going to say it's unusual for a graduate student to write a book like this before their dissertation, but it's actually the first time I've ever heard of it. How and why did you do this?
The reason why it doesn't happen is because it takes a lot of very lucky factors like coinciding to make it like even possible. And so it was just a series of, coincidental, but like good opportunities. Basically, the story is that I graduated from Columbia in 2007 in the summer. May 2007. And I had a fellowship that paid for me to go to Cambridge for 2 years. My first year, I did an MPhil. I wrote a thesis on Marx. And then my second year, like the MPhil was done and I had funding, but nothing to do. And while I had been in Cambridge, sort of like right away, I was reading Eric Hobsbawm's memoir, and Dobb had been someone who I was aware of generally. And Hobsbawm in his memoir, Interesting Times, just like happened to mention that he had applied to Cambridge partly to work with Dobb, and that Trinity College, which was Dobb's college at Cambridge, was Hobsbawm's second choice because he wanted to just like make sure that he could be like as close to Dobb as possible. Mm-hmm. So reading this and just like walking around Cambridge, it struck me like this is interesting. Hobsbawm, obviously one of the greatest historians of the 20th century. Dobb, someone who I was like aware of as having written like a big book about capitalism that I skimmed at one point in my undergrad when I was an undergrad writing every sheet paper. So I like went home, like checked out. Did some Googling, found out that the only two people who had written anything serious on Dobb were Eric Hobsbawm, who had written the Oxford, Dictionary National Biography, that entry, and Amartya Sen, who I discovered was also a Dao student and had written a short essay on him. And there are a couple other pieces, but those were like the big like biographical entries. Then I did a little bit more research, discovered that Dao's papers were all about two blocks away from my apartment.
That is a coincidence for me.
I was in the middle then of writing this, my master's dissertation was on Marx's journalism in the 1850s. He was, it turned out, basically he and Engels were the foreign correspondents for the New York Herald Tribune, which at the time was one of the most like popular papers in the United States. And I've been really enjoying sort of piggybacking on their writing to get like a broader history of the 19th century. And I thought that with Dobb, I'd be able to sort of do the same thing for the 20th century, that he would be my entry into these debates. There's a lot of them focused on political economy, but really some of the most, like, for me, like, compelling issues of the 20th century that, and maybe this was just sort of like a nascent historian's instinct, that I wanted to go into these subjects, but I thought it would be great to do it from a particular vantage point, just to give me a slightly different entry into them. And that's what I did. Like, over the summer of that year, so the summer before my second year in Cambridge, I, like, read all of his books. In the fall and winter, I went through his papers. Then in the spring, I wrote up a really, really, really bad draft, like a very quick, very like dirty draft of the book that was, enough to get a contract with Palgrave, the people who published the book eventually. And once I had like that hook in it, I sort of felt compelled to, you know, legally, I guess, in addition to morally, to actually finish the book at some point. So by the time I left Cambridge, I had this draft of like something, like a massive material. And at that point I knew I was going back to the US. I was going back to Columbia, starting up a PhD. And I'd been told by everyone that, you know, the first couple years of graduate school when you're doing coursework, it would be the most intense, like rewarding, soul crushing, like everything intellectual experience that you could imagine. So I basically just put the Dobb book into a corner for a couple years. I came back to it once I had passed my orals, once I had defended my prospectus. And then, like, luckily, just because I managed to finagle some funding, that gave me time off of teaching, so I wasn't, like, pressed with many other obligations, I was able to take about 6 months to do, like, a floor-to-ceiling rewrite of the book from, like, you know, the benefit, like, after having had the benefit of, like, years of graduate coursework of sort of, like, learning what a historical monograph is really supposed to be, like, what a work of scholarship is supposed to be like. And politically or intellectually, I think one of the biggest benefits for the book of this process is that I started writing this. So, like, I am like researching writing this book during financial crisis in 2008, and it's a very particular framing. And I actually was coming at it in basically like a very, very sympathetic to Dao's perspective. I'm just, like, you know, not a Stalinist. Like, that is impossible in 2008 for like a good child of American suburbia, but like broadly speaking, like, you know, very sympathetic to like some kind of like Marxist perspective. And over the course of my first couple years back at Columbia, I found myself, you know, drifting more toward, this might just sound like uselessly like theoretical, dark and heavy, but I mean, in some sort of like post-Marxist perspective that, basically, I feel like I try and, like, retain a lot of desire to, like, go big, like, ask, like, important questions about, like, the course of history, blah, blah, blah. Some of the stuff that had been most compelling to me about Marxism in the first place, but without some of the, like, more doctrinaire elements of it. That's, like, a glib way of putting it, but not entirely wrong. Anyway, the point is that I ended up rewriting the book from, I wrote the first chapter of the book from the alien perspective very close to Dobb. And then I rewrote it with considerably more distance. And I think that combination, basically, I had the energy to write the book to do the research and initial writing the book because I kind of thought he was right. And then I rewrote it with, as I said, like more distance. I think that gives you, it's a much richer version than it would have been if I had just been able to like crank it out in 2 years or something when I was still in intensely Marxist mode.
That's an excellent answer because it weaves the genesis of the book into your life. And one of the points of this show, and you may know this because I know you listen, is that books don't fall out of the sky, that actual people write them and that they are a kind of a part of your life. I like to think of it as like you marry the subject for a while. And when the thing goes away, you divorce and then you probably try it again, but it's very painful. You know, you don't want to let it go. And So yeah, that was an excellent answer. And it's probably, it's either going to prompt people to want to go to graduate school or it's a cautionary tale. I don't know. I will leave it to the listeners.
Oh, it's great. I wouldn't trade it for anything. What are you talking about? It's wonderful.
Okay.
Every time I contemplate, like, what would have happened if I, like, left school after undergrad, if I hadn't gone to Cambridge in the first place? What would have happened if I had, like, left school after Cambridge? I mean, I'm aware, I guess, theoretically, that intellectual development can happen outside of universities, horrifying as that might be for me, such a child of them to contemplate. But it's just been such a wonderful intellectual environment. Yeah, yep. This is just the random ad for graduate school, in case anyone...
Okay, there we go.
Podcast.
All right, there was an ad for graduate school. There you have it. So, you know, I guess I want to ask this question. Before we talk about – well, it's two questions. Sure. Before we talk about Dobb, and the first question is – and try to be – I was going to say try to be brief here, but go on as long as you want. What is political economy? We don't hear about that anymore. Nobody says I'm a political economist as far as I know.
Yeah.
They used to, and I'll tell you that they definitely used to, but nobody says – everybody's – you get a degree in economics and that's it. And there's no such thing as political economy as far as I can tell. What is that?
Yeah. Well, there's still few journals out there that will call themselves like journals of political economy. But political economy originates as sort of like circa 18th century description for, like, the easy version would be to say political economy is the 18th and 19th century version of what economics is today. But that's an oversimplification because political economy, I mean, it is people talking about stuff that we could class as economics if we wanted to, but it's part of a, like, larger discourse that is really oriented less around, say, like, the creation of fancy mathematical models of the economy or of markets or whatever, and these more thickly social historical descriptions of how economic exchange, economic activity, whatever works. And that, so that is the tradition through basically like 1900. The term falls into disuse sometime around the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century in the English-speaking world. It's replaced with economics, which is a conscious decision to try and distance the discipline from these more humanistic historical origins and place it more as, you know, a resolute social science. It's part of like the broader process of disciplinarization that you see happening at the end of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. But the term is like retained almost like polemically by, and I think this is sort of like lurking underneath your question, the people in the 20th century who are most likely to identify themselves as political economists or specialists in political economy are Marxists. Mm-hmm. That like they are self-consciously situating themselves in a position that even in their genealogy, you might say, begin with Adam Smith, go to Ricardo, culminate in Marx, then was abandoned by succeeding generations of perhaps like bourgeois politics, and they're reviving it. For me personally, just in my own intellectual autobiography, one of the most important influences early on was Eugene Dinovese. His first book, he's a Marxist, was a Marxist U.S. historian. His first book is, among other things, like a self-described exercise in political economy. And it was a term that for Dobb had especially like powerful resonance.
Mm-hmm. That was an excellent answer too. It does become strongly associated with a political kind of cast of mind, I guess I would say. But it was also a real thing. I mean, it was a way of studying the sort of production and distribution of things that is largely lost. I was actually reading in another connection the biography of John Maynard Keynes. And I'll confess that I was reading it on Wikipedia. and I followed one of those trails on Wikipedia until I found out that I think, and maybe somebody can correct me, the first book that John Maynard Keynes, the most famous economist in the Western world and everybody's darling, the first book he ever wrote was a book on statistics. I think that goes to your point right there.
Yeah,
he was.
Although, by the way, this is just on the question of a political economy today. I'm holding in my hand right now the galleys of this book called Capital in the 21st Century by Thomas Piketty. Mm-hmm. It's a book that like lots of people are talking about right now because it is like the best book on inequality that has come out. Basically, like Simon Kuznets is an American economist. Yep. Did some great stuff on that in like the 1950s. But one of the most striking things about this book and about what Piketty's trying to do here, he's like, it's another attempt to like revive political economy, saying that this is a work of like statistically informed, like deeply empirical economic research. But again, even though Piketty's not a Marxist, when you use political economy, often it has its polemical force. It's trying to indict the contemporary practice of economics as basically like fancy mathematical theorizing that's become completely detached from any like fundamentals of the social world, historical world, whatever.
So my second question, and this is, it's not an aggressive question, but I think it needs to be answered, and it is this: why should we care about Maurice Dobb today?
Yeah. That's a great question. And something that obviously I felt like very compelled to provide like a decent answer for in the book. But I think there are a couple reasons for it. The first one is, all right, so this is, I'll be like super narcissistic and biographical, autobiographical. Like I started writing this when I'm like in my early 20s, broadly situating myself as like part of the academic left. And so it's sort of like, obviously, there's like an appeal for like biography. I mean, it's like one of the strengths of the genre, going back to Plutarch, right? Like you want to look at a life and see like what lessons you can get for yourself. And Dobb, an incredibly smart person, had lived for a very long time. Born 1900, dies in 1976. Over like some of the most like fascinating, in my opinion, like decades in the history of humanity. Someone who was able to produce like some brilliant academic work and make some like truly boneheaded political decisions. And some very smart and stupid political decisions.
Who doesn't?
Like there should be a lesson there for, you know, it's like for me, it's like, oh, maybe I can like pick up some like pointers on what to do and what not to do for myself. But like less narcissistically, I think there's also my mantra when I was rewriting this was that there are no small historical subjects, only small historians. Mm-hmm. And like the conceit behind that would just be that you can do a tremendous amount of analytic work with even just an individual life if you know how to frame it appropriately. And like, as you know, in the introduction, I try and like step back and do like the view for 10,000 feet justification for why Dobb's life is like particularly relevant. I mean, would you like me to go into that here?
Yeah, please go ahead.
Okay, great. So, and this is maybe like unredeemably pretentious, but I actually do think that there's a point to this. There's something here, which is that when we think about like big narratives that we have for understanding like, you know, how we got here, the modern world, whatever, there are a couple that historically have like come to mind like very rapidly. The first is this idea that circa maybe 1700, 1800, there is like a fund, I guess you can cross them together, it's like the two revolutions narrative. And this is the narrative, of course, that's like most promoted by Eric Hobsbawm, one of Dobb's students. We'll get back to that in a little bit maybe. But the two revolutions narrative is basically this idea that modernity, democracy, our world today is a child of an industrial revolution and a French revolution, like an economic revolution and a political revolution. The industrial revolution gives us capitalism, which, you know, may be born in Europe sometime around, you can have debates over the genealogy, but born in Europe, diffuses over the world, like remaking everything along its way. The political revolution basically casts modernity as like a clash of mighty opposing ideologies, liberalism versus conservatism, socialism, communism, etc. And it's the interplay of those two is like what it means to, is like that is, these are the fundamental forces like making our world.
That's the story.
Yeah, exactly. This is the one that we all know, and obviously everyone as a story knows, and obviously we also know that it can be critiqued from a variety of different perspectives, that the Industrial Revolution story, like the Eurocentrism of both of them, the like empirical like inadequacy of an Industrial Revolution story that understates the complexity and significance of the preceding centuries and overstates the degree of growth like during the 19th century. Like there's the attacks you can level on that, like Deepesh Chakrabarty provincializing Europe. I mean, these are things that like all sorts of like ways you can go at, you can critique these narratives. Right. But anyway, like we still know that there's like something big that happens. Like being a person circa 2014 is very different than being a person 1800. There is like something big that happens there. And so I have those two narratives in mind. And there's a third, which you can think of, I mean, it's basically like a Foucauldian narrative, but Steve Kotkin calls it like the rise of the welfare state narrative. And what I find appealing about this is basically it says, instead of looking for sort of like big epochal transformation, like industrial revolution or liberalism or whatever, it says, why don't we pay attention to the evolution of the practices of power, of like political power in very like specific ways to see like what those transformations can be. Like what happens if we take certain objects, like say the population in the 19th century, and examine the changing discourses and set of practices that emerge around them. And for me, this is something that I really had in my mind when I was coming back and revising the book. It seems to me that there's important transformation that historians of the 20th century in particular need to get their heads around, and they haven't really, which is basically like the reinvention of politics around the social sciences over the course of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And that's like what it means, like the tools that we have for governing, the goals that we have, the people who are in charge of like realizing those goals, using those tools, all that stuff is completely recast, like to a large degree around social sciences over the course of the 20th century. And that no social science is more important in this process than economics. Mm-hmm. Right? So this is, maybe it seems like kind of, maybe this like three tripartite division seems kind of rambling, but I think there's a point to it, which is that Dobbs, because of his sort of like unique collection of circumstances, happens to be a really fascinating, happens to open up a really fascinating window into all three of these narratives. If you think about it, like he's one of the first people, Studies of the Dilemma of Capitalism, which is the book that if any historian remembers Dobbs, it's going to be for this. That is the first like big Marxist rise of capitalism story that you get in a single volume in the English speaking world. So he helped like write one of the most influential versions of the capitalism narrative. As a communist, like from basically he joins the party 2 years after its founding in the UK, 1922, and he's a member of it until his death in 76. He's a fascinating window on the ideology story of the 20th century. And because of his position as an economist, someone who was a student of Keynes, mentor to Marxist and tons of other people along the way, has also sort of this privileged access to a story about the transformation of political power in the 20th century that I think is both crucial and understudied. Mm-hmm. So that would be the short, I guess not that short, but that would be one of my, of the two notifications I have, sort of like the personal, hey, you know, like maybe we as academic types can learn something from this other academic type. There's the personal justification and then the more analytic one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He was there at the creation.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's kind of what I.
Thank you for summarizing that much more exactly than I.
That's okay. That's very good. Yeah. No, that's what I got out of the introduction. He was there at the creation. And he really was, because he was at Cambridge for so long. I mean, one challenging thing about writing his biography is he was always there. I mean, he went there in what, like 1920, and he didn't leave until 76 when he died.
Right? They have to take him out in a coffin.
Right. I mean, you know, like usually people go someplace and things happen to, you know, that kind of thing. But it's like, you know, this, wow. You know, I had moved more times, but by the time I was like 17, than he moved in his whole life. So anyway, let's talk a little bit about him as a person. He was born to great privilege, and he went to a fancy public school in the
British sense. Medium privilege. Like,
well, okay, go ahead.
I was going to say that he's really spent his life bouncing around sort of like the lower edges of Britain's upper class. Like he went to a prep school, but it wasn't like the fanciest of prep schools. His dad was sort of like, the Marxist vernacular for that would be like petty bourgeois. Uh-huh. So it's not like a total, like the better contrast would be someone like Paul Sweezy, who like he'll have big debates over capitalism with in the 1940s. Sweezy's dad was like vice president of Citibank or something, went to like Exeter, then Harvard. That's like the fanciest of the fancy. Dobbs is just a rung below that, which if you're in, you know, ferociously class conscious Britain, at this period, then like you're aware of that as a kid and for the rest of your life.
Right. Right. But he goes to this, what we would call this prep school. And then he goes and he goes to Cambridge, which was a completely normal thing to do. And then he does something unusual, right? He studies economics. I mean, economics was not something that most people studied, right? I mean, it was new. Mm-hmm. So go ahead and talk a little bit about
like
that.
It is like a very recent creation, although it's weird to study economics like circa 1900 or 1920. But if you're at Cambridge, it's less weird than if you are pretty much anywhere else. Like Cambridge at that period, you have sort of Marshall is still around, even though he's like older. But you have Pigot, you have Keynes, you have really the most intensive collection of significant figures pretty much like anywhere in the country, or in the world. It's sort of like they are like the cutting edge of disciplinization at this point. So if he was going to land anywhere for the study, Cambridge was the perfect place for it. Mm-hmm. And there's far more doubts actually that he would have been an economist if he'd ended up at Oxford or somewhere else.
Right. So an important question that I think people want to know is, did he bring communism to Cambridge or did Cambridge make him a communist?
Actually, he, when he's at Cambridge, is a member of, it's more like a testimony to the fluidity of the left at that moment, at least at that moment, if not others, in Britain. So this is 1919, 1922, like that's around the time when he's at Cambridge. And he's part of a socialist group. He's also part of like labor clubs, for the Labor Party. And sort of like floating around just different aspects of like the left of British public opinion. He doesn't actually become a communist though until he does his, until he's in London. He's at the LSE after he's graduated from Cambridge doing his PhD. And like that's when he joins the party. And then he is, after he gets his PhD at the LSE, he comes back to Cambridge and he brings communism with him at that point. Although, yeah, he is the first in Britain, at least the first academic hired by like a major university who also happens to be a communist. So to that sense, he brings communism with him, although it doesn't really get started in a major way, communism that is, in Cambridge until the 1930s. And that is for reasons that have nothing to do with Dobb and everything to do with the Great Depression.
Right. And you tell a funny little story about his, the beginning of his career at Cambridge. I don't know if it's the beginning or when he goes to Trinity. I can't remember which. You know the story I'm talking about?
I'm guessing that it would be the one that so Dobb is at Cambridge around 1920. This is at the same time that the university is experiencing an influx of student veterans, people, undergraduates who had put off enrolling at Cambridge so that they could go into the war. Everyone, like, Dobb is in that, like, first wave of students, like, re-entering Cambridge, which means that you have a lot of, like, very patriotic, very hearty young men who do not take kindly to even having, like, a self-identified, like, socialist in their company. And it's especially, it becomes especially cruel when you, like, remember that Dobb, like, from, like, sort of testifying to his, like, bourgeois upbringing, was always, like, a very natty dresser. And there was like some line that socialists and Cambridge had, which was that if they ever needed to, they could like use Dobb's trousers to print their to print their manifestos. They were like so tightly pressed. He would also, by the way, all the socialists, they always want to have meetings in Dobb's room because he had the best snacks. Like he would make sure to get them tea and eclairs, all that stuff. And actually, he taught one of his fellow socialists, J.D. Purnell, who would go on to be sort of a very famous scientist. He taught him how to tie a bow tie. Mm-hmm. This is sort of like Dobb's role in the Cambridge undergraduate socialist ecology. But anyway, Dobb and Eddie Dresser was like from time to time, like thrown into the river Cam by groups of student veterans, like fully dressed, like tossed in the water just to make a point. I don't know that socialism was bad, but will make you really, really wet. Mm-hmm. But yeah. That was part of what it meant to be a socialist in Cambridge in 1920.
Mm-hmm. But then I was thinking about the anecdote when he's I guess hired is the right word. I don't really know. He got a lectureship, or I don't remember the exact name.
Oh, wow. Yeah. This is what I used to open the book. Sorry. So this is I think it's a really fascinating story for a variety of reasons.
It's revealing as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So Dobb is 1925. He's coming back to Cambridge, and he's being offered this sort of extra like bonus position as a director of studies at Trinity, which is one of the oldest, fanciest, richest, et cetera, colleges at Cambridge. And he's being offered it by Dennis Robertson, who is one of Cambridge's eminent economists and was a mentor to Dobb throughout his life. Robertson, like, much more on the conservative side, but it's like, actually, like, as in yet, not just on the conservative side, like, he was a conservative, but, and sort of a very old school, like, type of economist. He was a classicist, actually, he had trained as an undergrad. And sort of like the image, fitting image of the British aristocrat, but he had like taken a shine to Dobb because Dobb was ferociously smart. And he says, like, offers one of his favorite students like this job, which is just like a nice little bonus. And Dobb accepts right away, and then immediately goes into agonizing mode because this is like 1925. He knows that he hasn't told Robertson, really, like pretty much anyone at Cambridge yet, that he has joined the party, that he is a communist. And he agonizes. Eventually writes a letter to Robertson giving what he says are the full facts, that he had joined the party, that like this was something that was important to him, that he wasn't going to give it up, and that he would understand if given his party membership that the offer to teach at Trinity would be withdrawn. And Dennis Robertson like writes back like right away. He says, Dobb, don't worry, as long as you give us 2 weeks notice before blowing up Trinity Chapel, we'll be fine. And the issue is taken care of after that. And like the thing that I think is really, I use this anecdote to open up the book because for a couple reasons, partly just because it's like a funny joke. Also, it's like it testifies to like the weirdness, captures some of the weirdness of Dobb's relationship. But also, a weird footnote to the story is that, so I don't know if like Robertson would have used this term to describe himself, but basically like Dennis Robertson was gay. that mm-hmm. he was a man who liked to have sex with men. And there's part of this, I just like this idea of opening the story as like two fussy white dude Cambridge academics, right? That is one version, talking to each other. And then that is sort of like what we'd expect to see from like a lot of stories about, stereotypes about like this moment and this moment in intellectual history, like this place in intellectual history. But it's also, you know, like a communist and a gay dude like talking to each other as well. Like hopefully that like suggests that there's like a more interesting world here than you would have. It's not just, you know, boring dead white men like yelling at each other about forgotten economic policies.
Yeah, it's very clubby. That's sort of what it struck me.
Oh, yeah.
It's very clubby.
I mean, that's why, that's why Dobbs can be a communist, like can be invited back, is that Dobbs' communism is an eccentricity not that different from Robertson's homosexuality.
Yeah.
That, like, once, and that is, you know, the provincialism, parochialism of Cambridge, it can cut both ways, right? It can, like, exclude lots and lots and lots of stuff. I think it's almost undeniable that, like, intellectually, it was vital for Dobbs that he got out of Cambridge for a while, went to the LSE, because he was exposed to, like, a much broader range of influences, German economics, American economics, continental economics more broadly. And, like, that was essential for his development. But, like, the upside of Cambridge provincialism was once you were in the club, you were allowed to go pretty much wherever you wanted to mm-hmm. because everyone assumed that you were smart and they trusted you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting to me, that world. I think that world is gone, but maybe not. I don't know. So I'm not quite sure where to go next, but could you talk to us a little bit about Dobbs's life in the interwar years? I know that he works with Keynes and Straffa and these mm-hmm. other people that we know. And so you'd take us up to, I guess, the beginning of World War II?
Great. So he arrives back at Cambridge, and he's, like, in circa 1925, he's, like, ferociously productive in his first couple of years. He has a book, he turns his dissertation, which is sort of partly history of capitalism, partly this discussion of economic theory using the entrepreneur, like, focusing on the entrepreneur and the question of monopoly, trying to use that to mount some sort of, like, fundamental challenge to bourgeois economic theory, as he would call it. That's his first book. Sort of a mixture of history and theory. His second book is the first, I mean, this would be of interest to you. It's like one of the first major English language accounts of like recent, like post-revolution Soviet history with a special focus on like the Soviet political economy. That comes out in like 1928, 1927. And he sort of like this like late 20s period is in some ways kind of like a golden age for Dobbs, like intellectually at least. Like he has like sort of the security of being at Cambridge, and he has like the political energy from being a communist, but there's still like a lot of flexibility with like what he's able to do. That changed from like both sides, like Cambridge's goal with what he wants to do. Generally speaking, he has the support of patrons like Keynes and Robertson, which gives him a lot of leeway. And the party is in like one of its more open moments. That changes at the start of the 1930s when there's a drive within the Communist Party of Great Britain, CPGB, to like close, basically this is the period of class against class is the label that is used to discuss to periodize it. This is when the lines of permissible dissent like shrink radically. And there's actually a kind of coordinated effort to discipline Dobbs, if not drive him out of the party altogether by some of the more like you can call them, this isn't quite right, but generally like anti-intellectual mm-hmm. elements of the party, which like leads to one of the most traumatic political experiences of Dobbs' life. So like basically the story is that he just tosses off this little pamphlet on like Marxism. It's called Marxism Today. And this is the early 1930s. He's trying to write for mainstream audiences a guide to Marxism, because this is a moment when British, like the British general public is becoming more interested in Marxism than it has ever been. And he wants to do his part to try and like bring some new recruits to the cause. And the Daily Worker, basically the official organs of the Communist Party of Great Britain, like freak out over the issuing of this publication. They use it as an opportunity to denounce him. He's actually hauled before, there's like negative denunciatory reviews in the Worker, other party journals. He's hauled before the Cambridge like chapter of his party, which is this enormously important institution in his life, and like denounced to his face, basically, as a traitor to the cause. And Dobbs, like, he gets up, he defends himself at this extraordinarily painful repudiation from his, like, fellow party members. Like, he does that by all accounts, like, what we have. He does, like, a fine job of that. But he's, like, shaking on the inside, you know. And mm-hmm. as soon as he gets out of, as soon as he finishes defending himself, he, like, stumbles out of the room, goes right to the bathroom, and just vomits in the toilet because he's like so nervous and so upset about that. And he stays within the party. He chooses to stay. He doesn't. You can spin this either as he doesn't let himself be intimidated out of abandoning a cause that he believes in, or he refuses to take the warning signs that this is not, in fact, a great way for him to like invest his emotional, political energy. But he stays in the party, like redoubles his commitments throughout the 1930s, which results in him, like, you know, he just throws himself into activism with the somewhat, for him, he would like later acknowledge this, like, painful consequence that while he is busy, you know, contributing to anti-fascist, like whatever, communist political activism, he is not engaging with debates among his colleagues, most called John Maynard Keynes, about Keynesian, what will become the Keynesian Revolution. Like the General Theory of Economics, the most important like text in the history of economic thought since the Wealth of Nations, like Dobbs has no idea what to do with that mm-hmm. when it comes out, because he's spending all of his time like working for the party, basically. And there's some, when he has academic work, it's like he's still contributing some major contributions along those lines, but he just doesn't have the time to take Keynes seriously. And as a consequence, he misses out on like the most important event in the history of economic thought, like in this period, which is happening just a few blocks from where he's living.
So how does his thought develop during this period, or is he so involved in activism that he doesn't publish?
Well, no. So he has, and this is the thing, he actually produces this book, Political Economy and Capitalism, which is
right.
one of his, like, most significant works. So, like, if people know, like, any of Dobbs' stuff, it'll be either, like, this yeah. book from the 1930s on economic theory or Studies in the Development of Capitalism. And there's a lot in the Political Economy, the theory book, that is, like, really great and really memorable, really compelling. And sort of Dobbs, at his best, his discussion of imperialism, which he links to fascism, is, oh, and this is something I should mention earlier, actually, like, he's a great writer. He was a joy to research and a joy to read, like, very charming, very everyday, compelling dude, but just a gift for lucid prose. Mm-hmm. He's capable of, like, churning this stuff out, like, in massive quantities, yeah. like, very, very quickly. And the stuff thing was just, like, I'm biased in this, obviously, but I do think he's, like, one of the best, like, I just as a prose stylist, like, one of the best economists that I've ever come across, like in his generation, in the 20th century more generally. Mm-hmm. So this book in a lot of ways is just like a joy to research and to write. But so he has this like work of economic theory, like / economic history, that is important for all sorts of reasons. But he would later admit that by missing out on what was going on with Keynes, he left out like what should have been like the pivot of the story. Because this is a moment when Ben Johnson, who's at Oxford, has done some amazing stuff. He has his dissertation book is on inequality and inequality, sort of the rhetoric around that on the British left. And his line on this, which I think is right, is that the British left in the 1930s is stuck in like kind of in a civil war between advocates of Keynes and advocates of sort of like a broadly like Marxian approach to political economy. And there was no person better positioned to like negotiate some sort of marriage between them, if such a thing was possible, than Dobbs was. And he's too busy organizing, you know, like anti-fascist propaganda sessions to really engage with that. So yeah, there are a lot of important theoretical, some fascinating theoretical contributions, just some great political polemics in his economic theory book, but it misses out on like the big story of the period.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, to ask another obvious question, I guess. He apparently knew a lot about the Soviet Union. He wrote a book about it. How did he assimilate? I think that's a nice neutral word. Assimilate the news of Stalinism in the 1930s.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to keep in mind here. I hope this doesn't sound so too weasely. Is that Dobbs' combination of like denial and favoritism towards Stalin was far from unique and not limited mm-hmm. just to communists
sure,
either.
Sure.
Like this is a moment when like the West are publishing, like, what's the book, like, Stalinism, A New Civilization, the first edition has a question mark after the title, and the second edition, they drop the question mark. And, you know, this is for a good chunk of the British population, like, you can see Stalin as kind of, the line is, like, a Russian Churchill, you know, that he's sort of, like, kindly benign Uncle Joe, and there's always enough room to, like, to dispute any accusation. So like that, the like famine in Ukraine, you could say that like this is a complicated scenario. There are all sorts of countervailing pressures going on. This moment when Walter Duranty, right, is going to win the Pulitzer Prize
yep.
for decidedly like not like exposing what is going on in the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And even when you have to admit that, like, okay, there are problems going on, they can be explained away by saying that, let's say, the kulaks are posing, like, a real threat, or internal dissonance among the communists is posing a real existential threat. Like, there's always some existential threat to the Soviet Union mm-hmm. that can be used to justify, like, marginalizing, dismissing these concerns. And then, when that fails, you can still say, granted, the Soviet Union isn't perfect, but it is an imperfect realization of deeply admirable ideals, and let's talk about capitalism for a while. Mm-hmm. Like, that will always be the move. Like, let's talk about empire. Let's talk about what's going on in India. Let's talk about fascism, which you can argue is the logical, like, culmination of what's going on with capitalism. That sort of, like, ensemble of moves, like, a mixture of, like, denial, some, like, aggressively misleading contextualization uh-huh. and shifting the conversation to the thing that you oppose. And keep in mind, it's not that hard to say that capitalism is a failed system in the 1930s yep. when the Soviet Union, like, economically is doing quite well compared to, like, what we see going on in the rest of the world.
Yep.
So if the choice is between, okay, yes, problematic, but, like, let's admire the ideals and let's think about the scope of the success, like, what has been done in just this, like, short period of time in Stalin's Soviet Union compared to a West that seems to be collapsing on itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what allows Dov and many, many others to get on board with the bandwagon. And then, to jump ahead a little bit, the story, like, during World War II will be, okay, and then the Soviet Union, like, because of communism, we win World War II,
mm-hmm.
right? That, like, without Stalin, without Stalinization, without industrialization, without collectivization, like, Hitler wins. And the mere fact of victory in World War II is enough to validate the Soviet model for Dov and many others, like, at least until 1956, which will be when the next crisis comes along.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about that. That was a good answer, actually, and I think you're exactly right, that it wasn't hard to deflect that kind of criticism. There were lots of ways to do it, and people as smart as Dov could do it. They could do it without being disingenuous. They didn't have to say no, this isn't happening. They could say a lot of other things and sort of just basically not answer the question about what was happening and say other things.
The obvious point too, and just to address this too, so, like, what do you do during the Hitler-Stalin Pact, right? Like, how do you account for this? Someone right. like Dov, who spent, like, so much of his time in the 1930s etching against fascism, what do you do when you have this alliance? And this is when he breaks out, like, the hardcore realpolitik argument, where he says that, and it's really fascinating to see it crystallize in this way, where he says, what matters is keeping the Soviet Union alive, because the Soviet Union is the best hope that we have for advancing the cause of world socialism. And if humanity is to survive, we need world socialism. Mm-hmm. So there are sacrifices that have to be made. I recognize that. But basically, like, making the Soviet Union into, like, the earthly manifestation of the socialist principle allows anything that justifies the existence of the Soviet Union to become good socialist policy.
Right.
And not out of naivete, but out of what you could present as a very hard-nosed kind of calculation about the best interests of socialist politics.
Right.
Now, there are all sorts of reasons why, especially from 2014, you could, like, slap your forehead and say, like, no, this is an awful decision. Like, what are you doing? But sort of I was impressed with, and this is just, like, my naive assumption had been, you know, that these are people who are just, like, they're stupid. They don't understand what's going on. At the very least, they're, like, woefully naive. But if anything, this is almost, like, cynical appraisal justification of being in the Soviet Union, of maintaining your support for the Soviet Union in 1939, 1940. It was surprising to me.
Right. But in 1939, particularly, it wasn't the communists that looked naive. It was everybody else, because the communists had been saying from the very beginning that fascism and Hitler was a disaster and it was going to be the end of them all. I mean, they were the only people who were right.
And this is when you have people saying, like, how, as a communist, can you support Hitler? How can you support this alliance with Hitler? Then Dov could throw, like, Chamberlain back in their face and say that, like, well, not too long ago, you guys seem to be pretty happy making alliance with him, or at least, you know, like, putting this conflict off into the distance. Like, what you wanted, you could say to his opponents, you wanted the Western world and Hitler against the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. Now it's the Soviet Union and Hitler against, like, France or whatever.
Right.
And it's problematic when it could be Britain, for obvious reasons. But the sort of claims to moralism in his ears ring hollow because mm-hmm. of what had been going on in Munich.
Right. So we talked a little bit about what happens during World War II. Let's move forward. You say the next big moment is 1956. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a traumatic moment for Dov. So that's a moment when you have 1956 is the year of Khrushchev's, like, so-called secret speech, where he reveals, like, some of the atrocities committed by Stalin. He's, like, open about that. And this is a speech that is supposed to be secret. Quickly disseminates, like, across the Western world thanks to the help of the CIA and the New York Times. And Like, that is one traumatic shell shock moment. Then there's, like, the putting down of revolution in Hungary, which is another, like, often cited moment in, like, the disillusionment of communists that happens over this period. Actually, Hobsbawm, in his memoirs, the book that got me started thinking about this project to begin with, says, recalls 1956. I think his line is, like, that was a year when Britain's communists lived on the edge of a collective nervous breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
Something that's, like, often left out of the story, though, there actually was, like, uprising in Poland not too dissimilar to what was going on in Hungary, and Dob was there. He was in Poland when this was going down, and it was what he would later describe. He says, like, it was the first time that I realized that contradictions were possible in a socialist society, like, seeing these protests, seeing these workers' rebellion, that it's actually in Poznan, the city where he's staying, and that we'll see some of the most violent protests. The protests, like, start at factories. It's like the Joseph Stalin industrial plant or something like that is where they begin. And they're put down quickly. But Dob, who had been part of this, like, visiting entourage of English economists in the country at the time, he goes out and gathers the sort of, like, bullet cartridges and shattered glass from when those protests were being put down, and he keeps them for the rest of his career. Sort of, like, he calls them mementos, they're reminders of this sort of, like, shocking experience for him. Mm-hmm. And this is a moment, 1956-57, when, like, large numbers of Marxists, like, not just in England, but around the world, will leave the party. And when you think about, like, the British Marxist historians, like, a lot of the big names that come to mind, like someone like E.P. Thompson or Christopher Hill, this is the moment when, like, they get off the train. They say, like, no, this is not for us anymore. Hobsbawm and Dob, though, are two of the biggest figures who stay. And the reason that Dob gives for staying, I think, is really fascinating. He says that, basically, he recognizes, like, he is very, very clear that the Communist Party in Great Britain, in particular, communism, Soviet Union in general, again, these are flawed vehicles for an ambitious program. But he says that a divided left, something where the Communist Party is, like, fractured in lots of pieces, or it's just scattered to the wind. A divided left is a useless left. It's an impotent left that won't get anything done. So, like, what we have to do is not, like, send the best people out, but rather, like, reform the party from within to, like, make sure that if there's any chance of communists ever getting power, of the, like, radical left getting power, it'll be by all of us gathering together and making some sort of change happen. And, again, it's a story that you can see, like, all the obvious problems with this. There's someone, the communists have, I don't think, ever gotten, like, you know, there's, like, a couple, there's, like, thousands of members at this point. They're, like, they're never going to be a presence in Britain the way that they are in France or in Italy. The idea of a communist electoral victory is just, like, absolutely absurd. But you see here also an anticipation, I think, maybe, of sort of what is not wrong about critiques of, like, a divided left that is incapable of uniting around, like, single, like, goals for, like, whatever, some sort of aspiration. And, it's just a really striking distillation of, like, a problem that leftists will face, like, generally. This desire for freedom, autonomy, like, individual expression, and diversity, along with, like, more hard-nosed attempts to, like, make political change, like, actually happen. And the problem is that Dob is just being, like, irredeemably romantic about the possibility of the Communist Party being a vehicle for change. But the paradox that he's isolating here is one that is more generally portable.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's also important to contextualize it in the Western European sense, and that is that in 1956, a lot of people did flee the party, but there were, as you point out, there were big communist parties in France and Italy. It wasn't like communism was a dead letter, hardly anything but on the continent. They were not doing badly electorally.
Yes. They're doing miserably in Britain, but they've always been doing miserably in Britain. And so the question is just, like, whether, this would be a debate that would be much more comprehensible. It would be much easier to have something like a sympathetic perspective to Dob if you were in France or if you were in Italy. Being in England, it seems like a little bit more detached from what was going on. It seems like there was room for autonomy that he wasn't pursuing, that you do have a vibrant new left that will be coming out of this, that will, like, face its own problems, but that he chooses to stay within the party, I think also ultimately has, you know, there's a bit of a biographical explanation for this as well. Right. The people who are leaving, like Hill and Thompson, like, a lot of them are, like, people who signed up with the party in the 1930s. For them, this is, like, a moment of, like, capitalist crisis. Like that is what the party meant for them. Where for Dobb, you know, he is someone who, he doesn't join the Communist Party officially until the 1920s, but he, Lenin is his political icon from when he's like 17 onward. When he's 17, he writes this sort of like quasi, his sort of his book, his novel, this is part of his frightening precocity and, how productive he was. He writes this novel called The Shadow of the Vatican, which is sort of like, Tom Clancy meets Lenin, like through the like lens of this like 17-year-old boy, and it's sort of, and they said there's also like a Jesuit conspiracy involved in some way. It's this sort of like ridiculous like pot boiling like spy thriller novel, but the hero of the book is this like barely like veiled like Lenin stand-in. Like Lenin is a person who's really like key to Dobb's little awakening, the hero he will keep coming back to. Like, and Dobb is someone who I feel like. He can repudiate Stalin, and we'll do that later, but he can never repudiate, like, Lenin. And that sort of, like, early identification with the party, in a way, it's kind of, like, analogous to Hobsbawm, too, who had, like, a very different moment. Like, for him, being a communist meant being in Berlin, being in Germany in, like, the early 1930s, like, part of this, like, resistance to the Nazis. For Dobb, too, it's, like, it's a different kind of political association, which is his, like, seeing, like, 1917, 1918, 1919, which is, as like Jeff Ely pointed out, this is like the only like real moment of like, for, like revolutionary like left upsurgence across Europe that you'll see other than like 1848 in European history. And that kind of identification is like deeply personal moment, and also like a singular one, because like he's not part of like the 1930s where there's like this generational turn. Dobb is fairly isolated in embracing communism early on. It makes it much harder for him, for just like obvious biographical reasons, to abandon the party later as well.
You mentioned the New Left, and I wanted to talk about them because when I was an undergraduate, it was after the New Left, but they were people I read with great admiration because they seemed to me to be very sophisticated. I'll just say that. And I guess I kind of aligned my politics with them when I was 19 years old and, you know, read my first book, basically.
This book explains everything.
I didn't, you know, I was from Kansas and I just hadn't, you know, I hadn't read a lot of books. And I started read these books. And so can you talk to us a little bit about what Dobb thought of the New Left and what the New Left was? Because this sort of eats up, in a certain sense, the rest of his life. So go ahead.
Yeah, well, and there are a couple of different New Lefts that we're talking about here, too. That's what's important to distinguish. Like, there is, like, the British New Left of late 50s, early 60s. So someone like E.B. Thompson, again, like Christopher Hill, Stuart Hall, be associated with this as well. Like, those figures, like, that is one group. And then there's sort of, like, the broader international New Left of the 1960s, which... And then for complicating matters even further, there's like the New Left of the New Left Review, you know, like right, Perry Anderson, Robin Blackburn, that right. sort of like really right. Marxist project.
Right.
And like actually generally Dobb had like a favorable view of pretty much all of them. This is like one of the things that I mean is appealing about him as a subject is that even though he had strongly held personal convictions, he was able to read widely. So Dobb, his last student, Keith Tribe, who went on to produce like some just absolutely like amazing economic history of economic thought, economic history. Dobb was the only person who was willing to supervise. Dobb became Tribe supervisor because no one else was willing to supervise someone who was basically an authoritarian Marxist, interested in like Foucault, this is sort of like all this like outre theory. Like Dobb as a 70-year-old, like 70-something professor is the only person willing to like take on that kind of a student. At Cambridge. So mm-hmm. I think that says something really valuable about him. Also, I mean, why is Marx's son? Why does he look back on Dobb with such fondness? Why does he call Dobb the closest thing that he ever had to a guru? That's Sen's language. It's because when Sen is a graduate student in economics pursuing his PhD at Cambridge in the 50s, Dobb is the only person who's willing to talk about Kenneth Arrow, rational choice theory, the stuff that Sen is really excited about, will make a career developing. Mm-hmm. Dobb is the only person in Cambridge willing to have those kinds of conversations with him. Mm-hmm. I think you can make an argument that sort of the total marginalization that he faced as a Marxist maybe encouraged a more flexible disposition toward like theory or whatever that's ruled out of bounds generally. So Dobb is someone anyway who politically he can look with like some favor, even though he wishes that people like Hill and Thompson had stayed in the party, he can still like approve of their scholarship. He can be excited when people like Genovese or Habermas, as they will, like cite approvingly like Dobb's work. And he can say that there had never been a theoretical journal of more interest and excitement than the New Left Review, which is what he will say in the 1970s.
I think that's kind of right. I mean, when I read it as an undergraduate, I thought it was really amazing. I just thought it was
amazing. Yeah, I mean, the project that they're going, the project the Milk Review is undertaking in this period is basically, like, importing continental theory, like, translating that for English and, to a lesser extent, like, American audience. And Dobb will say, like, right on, this is great. I have some caveats about the project. There are things I'm worried about. Maybe I don't buy, like, students as revolutionary, like, agents of change quite as much as I get the sense that you guys do. But he's, like, 100% behind it. And it's someone, like, he'll be excited. He'll be, like, engaged with, like, Gramsci, like, those kinds of attempts to produce, like, more richer, complicated, subtle, nuanced, like, whatever Marxism. He's never opposed to that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. even if in his own work he's not developing it as aggressively, because he's more concerned mm-hmm. with questions of political economy. And this is a story, too, right? And you see this, Perry Anderson's, one reason why it's interesting to study Dobb, like, part of the story of academic Marxism in the 20th century, as, again, Perry Anderson points out in his writings on Western Marxism, is the relative, like, weakening of political economy as a center of scholarly interest and engagement with, like, Western Marxism with questions of, you could say, like, ontology, aesthetics, philosophy, social theory more broadly, like, whatever. Dobb is someone who, like, he can be supportive and engaged with what's going on that front, but trying to contribute, like, original, like, economic contributions to Marxist theory, which from, you know, from 2008 when I started writing this to 2014 when it's out today, is something that, you know, this seems like there's a moment, our particular moment, one where people are searching for some sort of rebounding political economy, Marxist or otherwise, which mm-hmm. makes Dobb sort of interesting to come back to for particular presentist reasons, in addition to the biographical and historiographical arguments that I outlined, that I sketched at the start of our conversation.
Mm-hmm. And what about his relationship with Hobsbawm, who becomes famous?
Yeah.
And I want to – I guess I'm a little bit hesitant to call Hobsbawm famous, but that's the world I live in. And he is famous in my world.
No, but he's famous in the UK too, yeah. Right? Like, he's someone, I'm pretty sure his obituary was, his death was, like, on the front page of The Guardian.
Or yeah,
like
that may be.
Like, he's a celebrity figure in the UK in a way that he's not. And he's also, I mean, if people know the name of a historian, there is a good, even in the United States, there is a good chance that it's going to be Hobsbawm. I mean, I was in Argentina a couple months ago. And the Ages series, the Age of Revolution, Age of Extremes, Age of Capital, Age of Empire, like, those were all, like, prominently displayed in, like, Buenos Aires bookstore, like, mm-hmm. and within, like, 10 minutes, within, like, 10 seconds mm-hmm. entering, I see, like, the Eric Hobsbawm display. So, yeah, he has a worldwide reach that, I mean, the rest of us can only envy.
So how does Dobb see this? I mean, how does he relate to this?
Yeah, from what I can tell, they, like, very, very affectionate. Like, Hobsbawm will say that he got, like, that he thinks that Dobb is, actually Dobb's last thing that he writes is a chapter for a volume on Marxism that Hobsbawm had been editing. And Dobb, so, and this is Dobb is in his 70s when he's doing this, like, literally he'll die a month or something after he finishes the article off to Hobsbawm. And Hobsbawm, influencing the chapter from him, will say that, you know, I got still, like, most of what I know about Marxist political economy from you, mm-hmm. and that, like, you're still, like, the best person on the subject. And Dobb will always, like, look with approval on what Hobsbawm is doing. I think the distinction, though, is that because Hobsbawm went off in his, like, more historically oriented direction, whereas Dobb stayed sort of straddling history and economic theory, that there wasn't sort of, like, a direct, as direct, like, sort of a scholarly line of influence. Actually, it's someone like E.P. Thompson will be more ready to acknowledge Dobb's, like, direct intellectual influence. He'll say that I didn't need to do sort of big structural economics in the making of the English working class because Marx and Dobb had done that for me already. Mm-hmm. That his book is sort of, like, written around the sketch that Marx used in Capital and that Dobb systematizes and cites the zone of capitalism. Mm-hmm. But for Hobsbawm, actually, one of the important moments, so beyond just ending up at Cambridge, he says that on Marxism Today, that little pamphlet that got Dobb in such trouble with the party in the early 1930s, that was one of the key texts in Hobsbawm's own political awakening. And he said, not knowing sort of the personal history, like all the trouble that volume had gone, or that pamphlet had gone Dobb into, he'll say, I think in an introduction to Dobb's Fesh trip, like, he wonders, like, just how many cafes in England, like, sort of ferocious, like, excited young communists were ferociously debating the issues generated by that little pamphlet, like, how many people that sort of, like, their gateway drug to Marxism, as it was, like, for him in some capacity.
Mm-hmm. And the last question I want to ask about Dobb, and then we'll ask about what you're doing now. How is he remembered today on the British right or left or center or wherever? Is he remembered?
I'd say he's generally forgotten, but he still had a sort of surprising and paradoxical legacy, which is that, so Dobbs saying, like, he's remembered, like, they're, actually, I think probably in Latin American countries, I've had, like, the most interest in people who, like, where Dobbs is still, like, a major presence. Like, when I was in Argentina, friends of mine were telling me that they say, like, Hobsbawm, Thompson, then Dobbs. Mm. Like, somehow, like, Dobbs has, like, has a little bit more traction there than in the English-speaking world. But I'd say that via some people, like, especially, like, Robert Brenner, who's an economic historian at UCLA and who writes regularly for the New Left Review, it's sort of like, and people like Elmi Sims Woods as well, like Dobbs' analytics, sort of the approach to capitalism that he develops in Spaces of Development Capitalism. Wow, that was a Hiroshi sentence. Dobbs' approach to the study of capitalism has basically become, like, the general disposition to it has become essential to a lot of, like, Marxist left-wing attempts to, like, understand, like, what is going on with capitalism. Mm-hmm. And as you know from reading the book, like, I have a variety of problems with, like, that approach, but it is strikingly extent to which I think you can still see, like, very strong, and sometimes Brenner will explicitly acknowledge, like, Dobbs' influence. Actually, and according to a syllabus for one of his classes that I found online, a class from, like, maybe 2012 or something like that, mm-hmm. Brenner has, like, some history of capitalism course, and, like, the first book that they read is Dobbs, mm-hmm. Studies in Development Capitalism. It sort of, like, helps frame what comes after. And you see that in Brenner's own work as well. Mm-hmm. So this approach to capitalism has become part of, like, the common sense of, like, what it means to talk about capitalism for a good chunk of the intellectual left.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for all that. We've taken up a lot of your time. It's a really great book. I found it very interesting, and talking to you was even more interesting. And I probably could go on for another hour about this, but we can't do that. So to conclude the interview, maybe you could just say a few words about what you're working on now.
Great. Yeah. Well, the Dobbs thing was always, like, I came to Cambridge and I was doing, like, European British history because I was in Britain/Europe. But I had always intended to come back and do U.S. history. That was my first passion. And I'm picking up on one of the sort of themes I traced through the Dobbs book, which is this question about sort of, like, practices of politics, the rise of economists, and in particular, the emergence of, like, the economy as something that people seem to have, like, all sorts of really strong opinions about. And that for some reason is, like, the state's responsibility to be, like, guardian, promoter, defender, whatever. And it's something you can see developing. But the economy is not something that Dobbs or pretty much anyone is talking about in the 1920s in the English-speaking world. And it's something that will become really, really important, essential, and unavoidable by the 1950s. So my dissertation is, like, trying to explain, like, how this happens in the U.S. in the United States. Basically, so the emergence of the economy as, for the first time, like, the central object of, like, domestic political governance between World War One and the Great Society.
I mean, it's a fascinating topic. I do often wonder why we're so interested in these things. My friends who are stockbrokers and things like this, fund managers, and, you know, you meet these kinds of people, all tell me that I just should not pay any attention to this stuff. That's what they say. They said, it's just like, it'll just make you anxious and worried. So just don't even look at it. So anyway, today we've been talking to Tim Schenk about his book, Maurice Dobbs, Political Economist. And the first thing I want to do is thank Tim for being on the show. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a blast.
Absolutely. And the second thing I want to do is say that I'm Marshall Poe, and I'm the host of New Books in History. I'm also the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. And I want to thank everybody for listening today. I hope you have a great week.